Welcome to Radio Contra, coming at you live from the radio room behind a transmitter that looks conspicuously like an ICOM 7200 deep in the heart of rural northern North Carolina. And I am the Commandante of the Mossy Oak Militia NC Scout and bringing knowledge, useful information, and hopefully a little bit of entertainment here and there to all of you out there. It is really good to be back with you. And, trying to get a lot of content kicked out because, just like in episode 110, was talking about work ethic. You got to keep your nose at grindstone. Got to keep your nose to the grindstone and keep working and work. And, with that said, a mountain of emails. I'm trying to sift my way through them. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to have a whole lot of emails out there. So if you've been kind of back cataloged, tomorrow morning, I'm setting aside some time to do that. Earlier today, had a kick-ass interview with Brendan O'Connell. Should go listen to that. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think most of you will too. We're talking about some maybe controversial subjects in certain circles. International banking, the role that it's playing in a lot of this, and the internal workings. And I thought it was a great interview. And really, really enjoyed it. We're going to have Brendan back on to dive deeper into a handful of other topics as well, but getting down into the meat of it, I keep coming back to the idea of the power elite that's out there, right? The power elite, the power brokers that have graduated from the nation's most elite institutions, and how they maintain themselves in a status of power, whether that is a power broker of industry, a power broker of politics, or power brokers of the military-industrial complex, as it were, as well. It is a hypothesis that I would say that I took from C. Wright Mills, as well as Gary Allen with None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Of course, Gary Allen, both of them from very different political ends, and where they converge, because they're both right. They're both right in their observations. And with C. Wright Mills, who was a little bit earlier about things, and with Gary Allen coming out of John Birch Society in the 1970s. But they were both very succinct in pointing out that none of these things, especially this political theater that we see on a day-to-day basis, none of these things are happening by accident, because they're absolutely not. This stuff is bread and circuses, dog and pony show that is put on for the cameras. And I suspect, and it's my theory on this, my own formulation, that a lot of this is meant to keep us divided. And to keep us divided, which will keep us down, and to create these artificial divisions out there between people, which is really unfortunate. It's really unfortunate. And I have a friend from South Carolina who has trained with me a number of times, and The last time that he was up for a carbine course, we were getting ready for the night portion of the course, and we were sitting there and we were talking about kind of the tragedy of the divisiveness in this country and the tragedy, the nature of the divisions, and how kind of individually we think a lot of it's being managed, it's being run. The media, of course, is a big part of that. And, you know, he was saying he's a little bit of an older guy, probably, I think, a little over a decade older than I am. So he was coming of age in the 1980s. And he said, you know, from his perspective, that people got along best in the 1980s. And, you know, when you think about that, in the 1980s, you had Ronald Reagan. Of course, not everything was perfect. Not everything was perfect by any means. And you know, people who lived through the 1980s know that there were definitely some challenges. The Cold War was at its height. But at the same time, American pride was also at its height. And American nationalism was at its height. And despite the fact that there were some social issues, there were some economic issues, there were some political issues, they're always going to be there. But at the end of the day, it was agreed upon, it was commonly recognized, that that which makes us American, that which makes us prideful in our nation, and the fact that America is the beacon of light in the world, because we absolutely are. We are the beacon of light, the beacon of freedom in the world. And if that eternal flame is extinguished, what will that mean for the rest of the world? It's a very scary proposition. And in the 1980s, it's a very interesting thing how pride in one's nation and the recognition of that fact, of what a nation can do when it is aware of its own greatness and its own capacity to be great, and it is reinforced all the way down to the individual level, that you yourself can do anything. The power is within you to be able to do it. What a notion. What an idea. What an idea for a free world. What an idea for freedom of the individual and freedom of expression. It's a sad state of affairs, and when we look to the left is always those who seek to divide. They're divisive by nature, mostly made up of misfits in the world, not really understanding the world around them, and certainly not understanding the ramifications of their actions. Like a toddler, they only seek to make a mess for instant gratification, not ever asking themselves who's going to clean it up. And that's exactly where we find ourselves today. They've made a wreck everywhere that they have been in charge of. Look at California, look at New York, look at Chicago, look at every one of the cities that has a Democrat in charge, which is most of them. They make a mess out of everything. And it's sad. The tragedies occur at the street level. The tragedies occur on Main Street, not on Wall Street. And it's sad. But we can pull ourselves out of this. I firmly believe that we can, and I firmly believe that we will. But it takes a lot of work. A whole lot of work. And it's going to take a lot of education. But we will get there. I have faith in the future, and I have optimism for this country yet. A lot of people out there and a lot of people that I interact with on a day-to-day basis don't, but I do. And as the prospects of Balkanization used to be a crackpot theory, and these days it really doesn't seem as much like it is. Well, just know that brighter days are on the horizon. They always will be. So, in this episode, I want to field questions that have come by way of the forum. And I haven't really done one of these episodes in a while because we've had a lot to talk about. We've had a lot of news stuff to cover. But it's one of those nights. I mean, how much can you talk about AOC? How much can you talk about Trump tripping all over himself with the vaccine stuff? I mean, come on. How much can you really talk about all that? It's time to talk about some serious stuff. It's time to talk about some questions to Radio Contra. And so there's a thread up over on the forum, forum.brushbeater.org. Go check it out at your earliest convenience, of course, if you are using Gmail, Hotmail, Yahoo Mail, or several of the other free, let's say, email client services out there that are really just giant spyware. You're not going to be able to access the forum. But if you are using more secured options, you're not going to have a problem. I get a lot of emails about this every day. So with that said, get over on the forum, forum.brushbeater.org. Like-minded community over there. A lot of really good people. A lot of great knowledge that is being shared on a day-to-day basis. So get over there. Get over there and check it out. It doesn't cost you anything. It's 100% free. I would love to have you. So, getting back to the questions to Radio Contra. So, this one is coming from my very good friend. I've done several podcasts with him now, Gunmetal Armory. And I have a question for the podcast, either one referencing this one or Sons of Liberty Live. What types of knives do you guys carry? EDC, loadout gear, etc. And why, or I should say, and why. So, EDC, everyday carry knife that I carry is something cheap. Here's the reason why. It's disposable. I can get it in any Walmart, and it is an Ontario Rat 1 folder. You know, made AUS-8 steel. It's made in Taiwan. It is dirt cheap, inexpensive, a very effective slicer. But could also be utilized for self-defense purposes, but doesn't look like a dangerous weapon. It's still, when you look at the aesthetics of the knife, it still has a overt purpose to it as being just a standard run-of-the-mill utility knife. It doesn't really look like something, if I get stopped by law enforcement and, you know, have a Terry frisk or whatever, it doesn't look like something that I'm going to be doing anything dangerous with. Now, you're probably thinking out there, well, you know, that's not really optimum for a knife fight or whatever other contrived things. Look, here's the deal. Knife fighting, which is the second half of this question, is not really something you want to be doing with a folding blade anyway for a large number of reasons. And I've carried a number of tactical-oriented, tactical blades over the years on deployments. And I'll be quite honest, the most I ever did with them is open MREs and cut boxes. Open ammo cans and stuff. You know, I mean, there's some really cool guy knives out there, and, you know, Emerson comes to mind. Emerson knives are legendary, beautiful pieces. But here's the deal. If I find myself in a bad spot and I got to stab somebody with that knife or, you know, cut my way out of that situation, I'm probably going to be ditching that knife. It really... You know, if you end up having to stab somebody and run, you know, let's say, I don't know, I'm vacationing in Belize or something, and I get held up at knife point or gun point or whatever, and I've got my blade on me, and I got to cut a guy to get out of it. Well, I'm not keeping that knife. I'm on the run at that point. I'm not going to sit and hang out and wait for law enforcement, which may or may not... be looking to roll me up also, you know, and shake me down for money in part of the third world. Man, I'm not doing that. I'm not sticking around. So, you know, you need to carry inexpensive tools that you don't really feel bad about dropping if you need to. And I don't have any emotional attachment to it either. It skins animals. It cuts boxes, it opens things, it does everything I need for it to do, and if I broke it and lost it tomorrow, doesn't matter, I can just go down to Wally World and get me another one. So yeah, that's my EDC knife. I'm not carrying an expensive blade, as something that is a daily utility tool. Now, when you're talking about everyday carry for maybe a different layer of, equipment, maybe I am carrying a fixed blade for a specific task. Maybe I'm going to be out in the woods for a while. Maybe I'm out hiking or whatever. It's a good idea to have a fixed blade. Fixed blade is superior to a folding knife 100% of the time, all day, every day. Okay. And I don't think there's anybody out there that's going to argue with that. And it doesn't matter what the intended purpose is. Fixed blade's always going to be better. Depending on what I'm doing, generally speaking, I have a Winkler field knife that I've had for a number of years now, and that's what I use. That's been my primary carry blade. I got a lot of other blades, though. Daniel Winkler makes an amazing knife, and in the last first line course, some of the students had the opportunity to use that knife and did all sorts of stuff with it and were really just blown away by its quality. There's a reason that Daniel Winkler has the reputation that he has, because his knives are really amazing and they're beautiful too. They're absolutely beautiful. Now, there is another knife maker out there who I am very good personal friends with out in Texas, who sent out a fixed blade that he and I designed together, and I'm going to have more on that up in the very near future. And made that out of A2 steel, and it is a 5.5-inch Warncliffe style blade or sheep's foot style blade, with a little bit of a twist on it. And I designed it specifically to be a field blade, and that is something that I would carry quite often as well. And being that it's A2, and I watched the whole process of this knife being built, I absolutely would stake my life to that one as well. So, you know, field blades, whole different thing. Whole different thing there. But again, I've got other blades that are perfectly serviceable in that role. I've got Essies. Everybody knows Jeff Randall. Everybody, at least in the bushcrafting community, knows who Jeff Randall is. Amazing guy. An amazing crew that he has over at Randall Adventure Training. And Essie knives are outstanding as well, being made over in Idaho by Rowan. And Sean Rowan really has 1095 down pat. I mean, they make great knives. One of the cooler ones that they're putting out that I really like, and I bought one, of course, the original ones, the Rat 7, which is an Ontario blade, and the SE6, which is pretty much identical. And there's kind of a checkered pass there between those two, but I mean, whatever. Both of those are real good blades, but the SE6 HM, the handle modification one, and this was originally, if I remember right, this was a Dave Canterbury knife, and he had designed it for the Pathfinder School. There was some falling out that happened there. I don't know what the deal was. It was a licensing thing and whatever. So it got renamed the SE6 Handle Mod, or HM. What a great knife. What a great knife that thing is. So, you know, another one, really cool, really, really cool blade, and a good one to carry for general purpose carrying, for cutting, if you need a fixed blade. So getting a little bit deeper into your question here, what type of knife training do the trigger pullers receive currently, if any? I'm going to say in the Modern Army Combatives program, level 1 and 2 does not include weapons. Now, I was a pretty heavy critic of the Modern Army Combatives program, which is primarily based in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. They went to the Gracie family, and that's really where it all came from. Weapons really didn't factor into the equation until level 3. And getting certified in level 3 was kind of a difficult thing for most infantrymen, line infantrymen, to do. because we just didn't have the time to do it. You didn't have the time to go do it. Some of the other MOSs could, and a lot of the senior instructors for the Army Combatives program came from other MOSs other than Combat Arms, at least the ones that I encountered. So I was kind of a heavy critic of it because you're wearing a bunch of gear. You're not going to be rolling around on the floor doing, you know, Gamoras and whatnot. That's just not happening. Okay. It wasn't realistic then. It was fun for the competition. And, for me, having a background as a, amateur wrestler, freestyle wrestler and submission wrestler, you know, naturally I was pretty good at it. I took to it really well. But it doesn't really apply when you're wearing a lot of gear. So we didn't really get much knife training per se, other than really just basic stuff. There's some knife sharpening and stuff that's taught over in SEER. But again, you know, that's not necessarily a trigger puller course per se. Although a lot of trigger pullers do end up going to it. So there's that. And I would say that they're really, at least at the time, now these things could have changed. I don't think that they have in this era of risk-averse Army. I don't really think it's changed much, but you just don't get a whole lot of knife training when it comes to knife fighting and killing with a knife. It's not like it was in World War II. And that's also not to say that we didn't at least go out and attempt some of these training events on our own time. One really good one is everybody putting on a white shirt and pulling out a red Sharpie, and that red Sharpie becomes your knife. And so you can actually come up with some pretty neat doctrine doing that, just basic combatives, sparring, with knives, and you're going to learn a whole lot. It's not really like Krav Maga, and it's not really like Sistema. Both of those martial arts, they romanticize this notion that, you know, you're going to be able to disarm an opponent and get out of a knife fight scot-free and not be able to get cut and all this jazz. And I'm here to tell you that ain't happening. That ain't going to happen. You're getting cut. If you are facing an opponent with a blade, you're getting cut, and you're going to get cut pretty bad if they have any level of training whatsoever and know how to target limbs, know how to target different areas of the body for specific purposes. You know, and this could apply to a lot of things. I mean, it could be a bum with a screwdriver. That's a really common tool that bums, criminals will use in strong arm robberies. Screwdrivers are a devastating stabbing injury, puncture injury. You know, and it could be something as simple as box cutters, because box cutters are cheap, plentiful everywhere. And that really goes back to what tools are you carrying? Because chances are very high that somebody is not going to try and rob you with a $300 Emerson knife. Okay, it's just not really realistic. But they are probably going to be using a box cutter or something like that. Okay, it's just something cheap that they can get for, you know, under a dollar at Harbor Freight. Because, you know, they don't have money. That's why they're doing what they do, is because they don't have money. Moving on with your question here, when a team goes out to do some work, do they carry perimeter alarms? Yes. If so, are they electronic, analog, or what have you? Or a more quiet perimeter alert? Is it strictly manpower, or does anything like that exist? Oh, yeah, absolutely. We had a variety of different tools. There's trip flares. Trip flares are pretty common. There's a real silent one that is out there that's not an actual flare. It is a chem light. It breaks a chem light. you want to use these on your avenues of approach. So breaking down Okoka, and I've done that in the past, and I really need to do a new specific post on AmericanPartisan.org on Okoka, to bring it back to the forefront, because it's very, very important for everything that we do. But yeah, there's a bunch of them. We had a ground sensor also that had a small infrared beam on it. A lot like a Dakota Alert. We had one of those too that would send out a signal over the embitter. So that's another one. That's another one that's out there. And, you know, of course, when all else fails, Claymores. Claymores work pretty well too for alerting, you know, whether or not there's people coming up your trail. So there is that. But yeah, absolutely. Perimeter alarms. Yeah, you definitely want to carry those. The Dakota Alert perimeter alarms for all the preppers out there, survivalists and whatnot. You know, Dakota Alert alarms, the little MERS ones, really, really useful tools. You know, so there are civilian side options there. If you guys had to go into a dangerous, non-permissive environment, what weapons would you carry? How would you carry them, and why? Oh man, that's what a hell of a question. And I'll probably be posing this one again to the Sons of Liberty crew on Thursday, because this is just really a good conversation piece. If I'm going into a dangerous, non-permissive environment, first of all, why am I going there? That really is the question that needs to be asked, because that's going to determine what my posture is. So a non-permissive environment basically means that I need to be unassuming, undercover, maybe it could be close target reconnaissance. Maybe I'm doing a surveillance detection route. Maybe I am doing a surveillance route. All the things that I talk about in Lessons from the Farm, the patrons only Podbean series, which I'm going to be talking about soon. Just put another episode up, by the way, more on non-permissive environment messaging apps, clandestine messaging apps. But if I'm walking into a non-permissive environment, which could be a big number of things, okay, a non-permissive environment could be me driving through Maryland with a concealed firearm. You know, that's technically a non-permissive environment. It could be me going into inner city Chicago and not looking like a lot of the people on the west side of Chicago that are there. It could be that. It really depends on what you're doing. So what weapons would I carry? First of all, as I said in the first part of this question, don't carry anything that you don't feel comfortable throwing away, because you're going to be ditching something. If I have to get into a use of force altercation, and look, you know, Jason Bourne and all that stuff, you know, Kung Fu and Krav Maga and wrist holds and all that stuff. All right, that really looks cool in the movies. I'm telling you, if, you know, as a wrestler, as somebody that has a martial arts background, I'm telling you right now, the last thing I want to do is get into a fight with somebody. Because if I'm getting into a fight with somebody, if I'm getting physical with somebody, chances are very high. I don't run around looking for a fight. I try to get in and out as quick as possible everywhere I am. I don't go around looking for a fight. I would rather not do that. And if it's going to get physical, it's going to be someone being the aggressor with me 99% of the time. So with that said, you know, if I have to use that tool, it's in a defensive manner. And, you know, hey, I don't want to stick around either and play question and answer after the fact. So it is what it is. Don't carry anything that you don't feel comfortable throwing away. Now, what I will say is that when it comes to bladed objects, there are a lot of tools that can be utilized, that can be carried, that are perfectly explainable that are very effective defensive weapons. And in this case, really, you need to be thinking like a criminal. As terrible as that sounds, I know it, you know, that's not really the best thing that you want to hear, but there's a reason that criminals carry things like framing hammers and, you know, drywall hatchets and masonry hatchets and that kind of thing, and hacking knives, because they're purchased inexpensively and you can get them anywhere. And there's a plausible explanation for it. So what would I carry into a non-permissive environment? Again, it really depends on what it is, what the nature of the non-permissive environment is, and it has to be something that I'm going to be willing to part ways with. So for all of you thinking, you know, my answer would be a tricked out Glock 19 with a red dot on it and, you know, suppressor and all this cool stuff. Not so sure about that. I carry a Glock 19 because it is a highly mechanically reliable weapon. I have tens of thousands of rounds down the tube and many, many hours of training on it. And so me using it is instinctual. However, if I'm going to be carrying a firearm in a non-permissive environment, something that I'm going to be losing, I'm going to be carrying something real, real cheap. Real, real cheap. So just keep that in mind. How would I carry them and why? You want to be carrying things appendix inside the waistband. If it is a small firearm, and I do mean small, something slimline that's, you know, not bulky, not operator, none of that stuff. If I'm carrying a pistol, it's going to be in appendix inside the waistband, right there in the center, because it conceals the best. And if you're experienced in doing this, you are not going to be reaching for your firearm much, because your hands are naturally right there in the front of your body anyway. So you're not really going to be having to resist the urge to touch your firearm. People do this innately when we read body language. This is a little thing that you should do next time you go out in public, is go out and see if you can figure out who's carrying a weapon and who isn't. And if you do know somebody that is carrying a weapon, if you spot them, or better yet, you could have somebody you know carry a weapon into a public place concealed. Now obey all state and local and federal laws and what have you. But if you're doing that, count how many times they touch the weapon, whatever it is, because they are going to do it. I'm telling you, if they're inexperienced at this, they're going to do it. So if you have it carrying appendix inside the waistband, it's not going to print. It's not going to stick out there. Now, if some of y'all out there have, you know, 15, 20 pounds that you need to lose before you can carry appendix inside the waistband, and hey, you need to be getting on it. But that's a good way to do it. Other slimline weapons, you can get away with pocket carrying, you know, the old school pocket pistols, parlor pistols, something in a small caliber. 25 ACP is real good for that. You got to remember, folks, when you're talking about small caliber handguns, there are more people that are killed every year with a 22 long rifle than most other calibers. 380 is another one that's real, real common out there that people are getting shot with. It's killing a lot of people every year. So these may not be your choice for a all-encompassing effective self-defense round. But I promise you, if you get into trouble and you put that thing under somebody's chin, it's going to do what it needs to do in extremis. I promise. You know, maybe not out to distance, but, you know, inside of close quarters confine, it's going to do the trick. So how would you carry that stuff? I just, you know, covered. You can get away with pocket carry if it is a small handgun, a very small handgun. Now, knives, Knives are always carried the way that I carry it. It's always carried strong side and where I can index it with as minimal movement as possible. My arms are proportionate to my body, so they're not super long, gangly arms, right? You know, I don't really have that. And I can index my weapons. I can index my tools with minimal body manipulation, meaning there's gross motor skills that we kind of sort of don't have in extremis when the adrenaline is pumping. I can still index all of my tools that I need, my weapons, my self-defense tools. I can still do that. So I'm going to be carrying its strong side while utilizing my left hand to get into those target zones, right? To cut and stab. And I am constantly moving my hands and my arms, getting in there because I am targeting those specific areas. Remember, folks, you're not sitting there fighting it out with a guy, okay? This isn't some Hollywood drama, Jason Bourne shit that, you know, the music starts kicking on and all of a sudden everything's going to be cool, at the, you know, at the end. Nah, I mean, you're in a lot of danger at that point. And you don't know what that guy has. You don't know what his capabilities are. And, you know, even if you're a, you know, black belt and 10th Dan in judo and all this really badass stuff, this guy who's a bum off the street, he might just catch you on your worst day. And that just is what it is, right? That's the nature of the game. So carry all your stuff on a strong side. And, you know, about concealment and all that, I mean, there's a lot of ways to conceal stuff on your body. It's really not too difficult, and I don't really think it needs to have much more diving into than that. We'll be covering this question again, though, on Sons of Liberty, because I think it is a good one. I think it's a real, real good one. And, you know, again, it begs the question of what your non-permissive environment is. Because if my non-permissive environment really requires me to be dressed as I am, you know, in normal circumstances, you know, me in pair of jeans, t-shirt, boots on, you know, looking like everybody else out there, right? Because you should be, you know, all a gray man is. There's a lot of fuss that's made about being a gray man online, a lot of prepping and survival stuff, right? They talk about being the gray man. All you got to be a gray man is look like everybody else and look unimportant. Don't have anything unique about you. You know, don't be rocking the super cool guy, badass killer t-shirt. You know, don't be doing that. You know, you can get away with Carhartt, right? All the way down to the footwear. Footwear tells me so much about a person. Something that a good friend told me one time when I was growing up is that you can always judge a man by his shoes. And man, that is a fact over and over again. There was an insurgent in Iraq, my second trip to Iraq, RKG-3s, which is it looks like a German potato masher hand grenade. And it's a Russian and Chinese anti-tank grenade that they were using to throw at the vehicles and kill the crew on the inside of. And we would always be able to spot the guys who were gonna throw those. Because let's think about this. It's Iraq, middle of Iraq, in the summertime. It's hot. Everybody's wearing sandals, right? Everybody wears sandals. It's just what they do in that part of the world. But you get that young guy, right, that military age male or maybe just a little bit younger, right, teenage boy. The boys are the ones that are always doing it because it's an honor-based society, right? They don't have women doing this kind of thing, generally speaking. Sometimes, I've got a couple of cases of that, but generally speaking, no. You see this kid, right, it's the middle of the summer, it's hot. Right. And all of a sudden he's got a couple of items on him that is masking or allows him to mask his biometrics. Right. So he might be trying to obscure his face somehow or, you know, put on a shemagh or a kefaya over his head, you know, so that you can't really maybe get positive identification on him if you're doing Overwatch. Right. But the biggest telltale thing is that he's wearing tennis shoes. Look at his feet. He's wearing tennis shoes. Why is he wearing tennis shoes? Everybody else is wearing sandals. Why is he wearing tennis shoes, right? It's little notes like that that you always want to pick up on your environment. And so if I go to a place, let's say, a non-permissive environment could be, my local town up the road from here. And you know, we're living in, occupied times, bad times, whatever it is, external occupation force, whatever it is here, right? I'm trying to just live my life that day. If I walk in town wearing a pair of combat boots, that's going to make them look at me. Whoever is watching me from a distance, immediately I'm going to be up a few notches on their radar. But if I come up in there wearing, a pair of Twisted X cowboy boots, they wear a pair of cowboy, or they make a pair of cowboy boots, rather, that I wear fairly often, that is made like tennis shoes, and they're a little bit better on the feet than wearing conventional cowboy boots all the time. I really, really like them, and I wear them pretty much every day because I can still do, even though they're pull-ons and they are cowboy boots, I can still use them to do a lot of things. I can run if I need to, I can move quickly if I need to, and they grip around my feet and provide me with that grip in my working environment. But the biggest thing is they look normal, okay? They look normal. They don't look out of place. They don't look strange if I'm wearing them, because a lot of other people also wear those. If I'm wearing hunting boots, same deal, right? It's the same deal. And I can accomplish the same goals that I would be if I was wearing a tactical-oriented boot and I don't stand out in the crowd. It doesn't look unique. That's really one of the biggest things about non-permissive environments or NPEs. And again, I'm going to be going into this in a lot more detail. Specifically, I'm doing a patron lesson on non-permissive environments and dressing for success on that. But there you go. So carrying weapons, obviously, I don't want to be walking up and down the road with my katana on my back. That's probably not a good idea. And even a lot of fixed blades, kind of, I don't know, man, when I see people carrying fixed blades out in public settings, it there's a connotation there with it. It's probably not something you want to do in all cases. Not in all cases. Now, if the scenario calls for it, and maybe we're out in the woods going for a hike or something like that, hey, no big deal. Right, no big deal. That's perfectly acceptable. But day-to-day stuff, fixed blades aren't really the thing. I hope that answers the questions, goes into a deeper detail for the folks out there who are listening to this, wondering about non-permissive environments and whatnot. It really underscores the whole thing. And again, I'm going to be covering it again in one of the patron lessons over on Podbean. But these guys that are wandering around dressed up like operators and whatnot, I'm telling you, man, it's just not realistic. Okay, it's not realistic for a number of reasons, and I'm gonna go deeper into that into the future over on Podbean. So moving on to the next question that I have on tap, a little bit of a more clean one. clean, I don't mean as in sanitary. I mean, just a little bit easier to answer, not quite as convoluted. And this is, of course, also coming from the forum. And, again, if you're not ever on the forum, forum.brushbeater.org, what are you doing, man? You need to be on it. You need to get on it. You need to rectify that situation most haste. Get over there. There's a lot of good folks over there. We run a tight ship. And this audience that we have with Radio Contra just really is blowing me away. But so this one is regarding compasses and which markings are best. So the options that are listed here, metric, UTM scales, and an inch ruler, you need both of those. USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, UTM scales, you need that as well. USGS, UTM scales, and direction in mils, you don't need that. And I'm about to talk about that. You don't need that in mils. Metric scales and an inch rule, that's goes with point number one there. You do need that. And then finally, imperial scales, which is an inch rule. Okay, so this is regarding specifically the MC2 compass that's out there. Now, my buddy Badlands Fieldcraft up in Montana, he's a giant fan of the MC2. I like the MC2. It has some features I don't think necessarily work for me. I'm a big fan of two compasses, actually, and in that order, because I always carry two on me when I'm in a working environment. The first is a Lensatic compass. Military Lensatic compass has been around for forever. It is bomb-proof. I have carried one in every operational environment that I've ever worked in and have used it. And make sure that you get the tritium version, okay? Now, that being said, the Lensatic compass does have a couple of drawbacks to it. It does not include a built-in point plotter. And so with a military Lensatic compass, you also have to carry a protractor with you as well. Small plastic card called a protractor that has scales. It's different scales on it, one in 25,000, one in 50,000, one in 100,000. And it allows you to plot points on a map. Now, also on a protractor, generally speaking, not all of them. I have a couple of smaller ones that came from Map Tools that do not include this feature. But on the military issued version, you have 360 degrees in a circle on there. So you orient your map to north, and then you orient the protractor on that as well. So you're going to get a grid direction. Okay. Grid to magnetic, you subtract. Magnetic to grid, you add, right? Always remember that when you go from general to major, you lose money. When you go from major to general, you make money, right? So that's what you want to keep in mind. Now, that's known as declination. With the MC2, it has the ability to adjust for declination. You don't even have to worry about it. Okay, so kind of a neat feature the MC2 has. The MC2 does have some drawbacks, though. It is not bomb-proof. It is not the most rugged compass you can get. It's pretty rugged. It's pretty rugged. There's a lot of people out there, a lot of land surveyors, timber cruisers, survivalists, you know, bush pilots, and all kinds of people out there that swear by the Suunto MC2. And I'm not here to be a detractor from it. I think it's a really good option. If it works for you, great. I do, however, do strongly endorse Suunto as a company. And my backup compass is the MCB. It is a $12 compass. It is all plastic. It is not bomb proof. But that's why it is my backup compass. And I use it a lot. A whole lot. Now, base plate compass, you got to understand, is different from a Lensatic compass. A base plate compass, you turn the bezel, you put red Fred in the shed. So any of you Boy Scouts out there are going to remember that. And that's essentially how you use it to get an azimuth or your bearing, your direction of travel, right? With the military Lensatic compass, you literally open it up and whatever the azimuth is that is pointing up towards the sighting wire, that's your azimuth, right? So both of them are pretty simple to use, but they work in different ways. Okay, so your options, metric, UTM scales, and an inch ruler, you need both of those. Okay, you need both of those. The metric UTM scale, understand too that UTM is not the same as MGRS, okay? I've had people in the past who were mistaken on that. UTM is specifically 1 in 24,000, Okay, 1 in 24,000 maps versus 1 in 25,000, which is MGRS, or Military Grid Reference System. UTM is the civilian version. It's what you're going to get when you get U.S. Geological Survey maps. And you need to make sure that that is what you're getting. You're going to find all this information in the margin, by the way, down in the margin. It's what you need. Pay very close attention to that. So UTM scales, you definitely need that scale to be able to point plot points on your map so that you can plot either points of interest or get a fix on your own location. It seems to be a skill that's frequently getting lost in this era of GPS and whatnot, giving you a grid. But just understand that that's how you do it. And there's a lot of competent land nav teachers out there. Badlands Fieldcraft is one. I know my buddy Jacob Inyart, Greybeard Green Beret, he definitely runs a course on that, as well as Dave Canterbury with Pathfinder School. He runs a course on land navigation that has got universal praise, as well as ESSI, Randall's Adventure Training, with Jeff Randall. They all run land navigation course, all of them great instructors. And I'm sure there's a bunch of other guys out there too. Those are just the ones that I know off the top of my head that run them, that I can personally vouch for. So, go check those guys out. But, USGS, UTM scales, and direction and mills. Okay, so you don't need the direction in mills. You need the direction in degrees, and here's why. Mills is used for field artillery spotting purposes for very, very precise, very, very precise azimuths. Everything else is done in degrees, and there are 6,400 mils in a circle. There are 360 degrees in a circle. Just use the degrees. We don't need to, don't overcomplicate things. Think about it like this. If your, 80-year-old grandma was to have to find her way through the woods, having never used a compass before, if she picked up your compass, whatever it is in your pocket, and had to navigate her way out of being lost in the forest, you want to make it as easy on her as possible. Now, I use that example because that is what we revert to when we panic. And there's a lot of people who end up panicking in the woods, getting scared of stuff, right? And being lost is kind of that sinking feeling. Like, you look around, the sun's starting to get low in the sky. You're like, man, what am I going to do now? It's a pretty scary thing. So keep your gear as simple as possible. If everybody's on degrees, that's what we want to keep. Metric scales and an inch ruler. You need both of those. I've taught land nav courses in the past, and I always show the students that you can use the metric ruler to figure out distance on a specifically scaled map. 1 in 25,000, 1 in 24,000, you can for the most part. It's going to be a little bit off, but it'll be close enough to being right. If you're just trying to get into the general vicinity of something and your terrain associating with your map, it's not going to make a huge difference. But you want to have metric. Why do you also want to have inch rulers? Because it's just a good tool to have. It's just a good tool to have. Always have, a way to measure in inches on top of measuring in metric. But that being said, metric has a lot of uses too. You should be familiar with both systems. I say things a lot in mills and utilize mills a lot because it is what I know, as well as all the other stuff in the metric system. It's because it's what I've used for most of my adult life. But, with inches and stuff, it goes back to what is the most common denominator? What is what most people are going to use? And be able to use and understand around you. Keep that in mind. So with the MC2, the other thing that I'll tell you, make sure if you are in the Northern Hemisphere, by the way, and because you're on the forum and, you know, you've been to a brush feeder class in the past, you're part of the Mossy Oak Militia out there. I'm assuming that you are in the Northern Hemisphere most of the time. You need a Northern Hemisphere specific compass, okay? Suunto makes that differentiation. If in doubt, look at the package, okay? And if you're still in doubt, contact someone from Suunto. Suunto stands behind their product 100% and then some. Can't recommend them enough, and I have absolutely zero financial incentive in that. I'm just telling you what good gear is. And Suunto and Kamenga. Kamenga is the military contractor that makes the Lensatic compass. Those two should be your options. Okay, right there. Full stop. Now, Silva, I think, has brought some operations back to the United States. Brunton may have as well, but they outsource their stuff to China. And I'm going to tell you from experience, their base plate compasses do not hold up. They do not hold up over time. So, you know, maybe anecdotal. If you think so, cool, that's on you. But I really don't trust their gear. Suunto has never failed me. Kamenga has damn sure never failed me. So those are your options right there for compasses. And with that said, you know, I'm going to underscore the training again. You know, get competent training. Get competent training out there with using a map and compass. And make sure it's a land navigation exclusive course. You know, I could teach folks how to use a map and compass, but really it takes an immersive course to be able to do that. And I've done them in the past. I just don't have time to add one to the schedule right now. I've got so many other courses that are going on into 2022. Some that I have right around the corner, right after the first week of the new year, down in Florida. We're going to be down in North Central Florida at Angry American's place. Angry American, of course, the author of the Going Home series and RTO, Advanced RTO, and Signals Intelligence out there for an entire week. If you only want to take the RTO course, it is going to be on the 8th and 9th of January. Shoot me an email. I'll get back in touch with you ASAP, get you registered for the course, tell you all about it. Love to have you out. I would love to have you out in class. And again, I'm not limiting the attendance to class, especially for these, because I really think we need to get as many people trained up as possible right now. Absolutely need to get as many people trained up as possible, because there's a lot of things at work right now. There's a lot of uncertainty in the world. And the more people that we have that have competent communications training, the better off that we're going to be. Now, that being said, that's just the beginning of what we have on tap for 2022. We are going to be burning it down on the training front. And as we get to the end of the year, again, we're going to be adding a couple of new dates on there. But what you see on the training calendar, brushbeater.org/training calendar, is pretty much set in stone, folks. It's pretty much set in stone. So, you know, those dates are it. If you don't see something on there, you know, maybe you don't want to travel or whatever to a course. Hey, you know, I was putting the message out there back in October. The people who showed up were the ones who got those dates for traveling. But that's it. That's pretty much it right there. And so with that said, check out the training calendar. Got a whole lot of dates up already up there. Comprehensive training in literally everything from communications to tracking to combat skills with the scout course to the carbine course that's coming up in March. And we're going to be doing a lot of training in various places, traveling a lot in 2022, traveling a whole lot. And that's all in an effort to really build that vanguard that the Power Elite is so shaken by. I want to give a shout out to the podcast sponsor, Civil Defense Manual. Civil Defense Manual, Jack Lawson's 2-volume comprehensive set on how to get a mutual assistance group or a neighborhood protection team up and running. Up and running. I wrote the communications chapter in it. You need to get these books. You can't afford not to have them in this day and age. Blacksmith Publishing had both of the masterminds, special operations legends, guys who are the real movers and shakers behind the scenes in the training of special operations as well. Had those guys back in episode 97, and they run Blacksmith Publishing. You need to go and check out what they have. I'm going to have a link down below in the show notes. Please, you owe it to yourself. The Army's Special Forces Small Unit Tactics Handbook. You need that book, all right? You need that book. Active Shooter Self-Protection. Definitely a topic in this day and age. Something that you might want to stay on top of. You know, as well as Paul Lefebvre's other outstanding books. He's put out Iron Sharpening Iron. Can't talk about that book enough. You need that in your life as a spiritual guide. You know, we are all facing hard times. I've got a lot on my plate right now, and I am constantly referencing that for strength and for strength in trying times. And you should too. You absolutely should too. Because if we're not right with the Lord for the afterlife, you know, then what are we? What's the point behind all this? You know, it's something you really need to be thinking about. And of course, Tactical Wisdom, Joe Dolio. I'm going to have Joe Dolio on. We're going to have an interview tomorrow. We're going to be recording that. And I am really, really looking forward to this and getting it up. So tacticalwisdom.com. Folks, as always, it is an honor to be with you. We've got the Patron Series. I just added another episode to that tonight, covering clandestine messaging apps that go on the clandestine communications device that I detailed in the last lesson previous to that. And I talk a whole lot about working with these apps in a non-permissive environment, some of the strengths and weaknesses of them, and what they can do for you. Go check it out. You will see that red icon in the corner if you are listening to this through the Podbean app itself, and that is the easiest way to index these patron-only episodes for as little as $5 a month. And again, I'm going to be putting up between 2 and 3, maybe more, of these lessons per week, getting them out there. If it's not a week, then I'm running one of the RTO courses, which, you know, takes me away for a few days at a time, 6 days at a time. And then, you know, of course, I've got my travel as well. But I'm going to be putting out a lot of content, a whole lot of content for folks who maybe can't justify coming out to class, can't get the time off. Hey, I get it, but I'm still here to train you. I'm still here to offer you the very most that I can. And in very, very precise detail, trying to give you the very most. And maybe these aren't necessarily courses that I can teach in person either. The interrogation resistance one is, you know, kind of something that's sort of tricky. If you're teaching a group of people that, it might be a more effective way to do it the way that we approached it here. But anyhow, folks, all in an effort to give you the most amount of tools in your toolbox for uncertain times and for dangerous environments. Again, it's been an honor to be with you in this evening. I hope that you got something out of this episode. God bless all of you. And this is NC Scout out.